Thank you. Well, we've been thinking a lot about things being contagious lately in the Lander family. A few weeks ago, the chief contagion entered our home. I think his name was Josiah. Whatever he had caught from his new job, and that's what we're calling ground zero, Mike, is your place of employment. It was new. It's like sending kids back to school. There's a petri dish that's waiting for them. And all of a sudden, something infects one. It comes home, and it infects others. And that's just the way these things go, right? Except for we're not really talking about contagions that way lately. What we've been actually thinking about in the Sermon on the Mount is a contagion of a completely different stripe. This sense that we want to infect our church with a way of thinking that makes you almost just an alien in this world. We want to infect people in our church with the thinking that Jesus is radiated out of the first chapter of this sermon, such that if you caught what he was giving, that you would be so affected, so changed, something would just so systemically affect your core that you just couldn't live a normal life going forward. Some of the sermons have kind of hit me that way as a cold, I gotta be honest. There are some of these texts that have just nailed me and laid me out. And last week's was one of them. Last week, the idea that if I'm struck, if I'm insulted, if I'm persecuted, that there's a strength that I'm supposed to demonstrate, but not one of retaliation. The strength that I'm supposed to demonstrate almost looks passive, almost looks subservient. We were able to unpack the strength underneath it last week, but it's so different than the way this world looks, because every movie, every example, every speech given by a president at a funeral would say and would model to young men in our country, the way to be strong is to hate your opponents. That sadly was a quote given by the president of the United States. I hate my enemies. And it was sad to see comments that resonated from that speech, that saw that as strength, that saw that as what it means to be opposed and to stand up in the face of opposition. And what I'm hoping is for any of you who saw that speech, that something had been caught deep in your system that said, I'm not sure I'm down with that. I'm not sure I'm okay with that. And if not, I just want to tell you from the beginning, I aim to infect you one more time from Matthew chapter 5 in such a way that when you are persecuted in the future, your model of strength is not one of retaliation, but of something altogether different. Title of our sermon today is Praying for My Persecutors. Or if we wanted to put it in a slightly more difficult way, because praying for my persecutors just sounds so very churchy. We might even say in a less churchy way, asking God to bless those who hate us. Or you just might say something raw that when somebody is your enemy, we want to respond to them in such a way that we're trying to figure out how to make their life as good as it can possibly be. That's not the way we normally think. We need to be infected by something. We need a new way of thinking that will alter us. And if you're in your Bible, you know that last week we were in a text that was titled Retaliation, and we are in the sixth of these that would then turn our attention in the form of Jesus saying, you have heard it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemies. But I say to you, that pattern is repeated here so that Jesus in verse 43 gives us the exact same formula. What I said last week is that this was going to be part two of the message that we heard last week. And if you didn't get to hear last week's message, the good thing is they are online. You can find them on YouTube. You can find them on our website. So go back and listen. I think it'll be helpful to set the stage for this one. Because Jesus, in the same way, the sixth time here as we wrap up chapter 5, says, "You have heard that it was said, but I say to you," and then he gives us something to test whether or not we've heard what he's just said. We're going to hear in this, and this has been so nice about preaching these little case studies. There's kind of a three-point sermon in every single one of them, and we're just going to respect the three-point sermon that's there in this paragraph as well. Point one is a hatred for my enemy. Point two is the kindness of my Father. And point three is then our choice between these two models. And so let's take a look at the first model, a hatred for my enemy. We see that right there beginning in chapter 5, verse 43. "You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy." Because Jesus puts forward the love thy neighbor portion of this, we do recognize he's quoting from the Old Testament. Leviticus 19:43 would say this: "You shall not hate your brother in your heart. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself." So important is this ethic of how to treat fellow Israelites that God attaches his name to it and says, "I'm the Lord." It kind of has that Yul Brynner, the Ten Commandments kind of moment, right? If Pharaoh speaks, so let it be written, so let it be done. I, Pharaoh, speak. Here it is. God's speaking exactly that same way. He's saying, here's the way I want you guys to get along as family members. I don't want you to hold grudges with each other. I want you to love each other. I want you to love each other as you would love yourself. Jesus is going to quote this radically in another spot. But here, as he points it out, he says, you've heard. You're supposed to love your neighbor. But you've also heard, he says, and this becomes the focus, you're then also supposed to hate your enemy. And it's hard to know where to grab that from the Old Testament. The closest we can get is the passage Leslie read for us. The closest you can get to a command to hate your neighbor comes from David's sort of language where he says, "Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? Do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with complete hatred. I count them my enemies." That's strong language, isn't it? And you could take David's confession here as a command. That mistake has been made already that Jesus has called out. Why is it that Moses commanded people to get divorced? And Jesus later in Matthew said, what are we talking about here? That concession was given because of the hardness of hearts. It wasn't a command that all marriages you guys married, oh, fresh, wonderful. God's command is for you to get divorced. It's not the way the law was working at all. In the same way, this assertion that because there are enemies of God, those aligned with God are going to view those enemies as their enemies. That's what Psalm 139 says. I don't like those people, God. They are your enemies, and because they hate you, I hate them. The problem is that that kind of celestial allegiance can get translated down to petty vengeance. Because if you have permission, according to Psalm 139, to hate your enemies like that, then the good thing is anytime anybody opposes my agenda, I can call them my enemy, and I can then bring the hatred of God against them, right? That's the way alliances work. Are we allied together as countries? Yes. Then if anybody attacks me, they attack you. And if anybody attacks you, they attack me. We like to do that with God, right? God, I hate those who hate you. Therefore, you hate everyone who offends me. This alliance isn't exactly working the way that the Bible seems to prescribe things. And yet, Exodus actually, in the law, prescribes a very different way of relating to your enemy. Listen to this. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall bring it back to him. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying down under its burden, you shall refrain from leaving him with it. You shall rescue it with him. That's one specific case study about how God commands the Israelites to be able to treat those that are opposing them. If you see one who's burdening you burdened, help him with the burden. That's right there in the law. And so what Jesus is about to say is not going to be contrary to the law. What Jesus is going to say is going to be contrary to misconception of the day, which is that God hates all the people that I hate. And he vindicates the fact that I hate people that are against me. That, Jesus says, is not God's disposition, for one thing. And it's not to be our prescribed disposition either. Exodus makes that really clear. And so Jesus isn't going to be sort of contradicting some Old Testament principle, much like he's done already. He's contradicting the twisting of an Old Testament principle, and he's delivering us to the force of where the law was taking us anyway. Exodus was really clear. I want you to do good to someone who's not doing good to you. So let's get there. Let's get to, from this concept of a hatred to my enemies, to what we see is the kindness of our Father. So Jesus starts and says, or continues and says, but I say to you, love your enemies, and then doubles down and gives a way of loving your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. If that feels a little too harsh, the problem is in another spot, Luke actually records this same teaching, but with a little bit harder kind of teeth to the command. He says, I say to you who hear, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you. This is what Jesus was after. And the problem is, it's not just our president who would have opponents that he feels justified in hating. The reason that this passage has endured, the reason that our Bibles are open to this text today, and the reason the Holy Spirit is active in the fact that we have opened his word today, is that we've got enemies that we hate. And we look for every rationale that we can find in order to hate them. Now, maybe hating them feels a little too strong, but maybe a better way of defining hate would be to look at the way that Jesus defines love. If Jesus says that love is praying for people, to use language from Luke 6, doing good to people or blessing other people, so trying to make their life as good as it could possibly be, that's what Jesus describes as love. Then if we try to describe what hate is, we could probably just take the opposite of those as well. The opposite of praying for somebody else might in one sense be calling down prophetic curses on other people, or it could just be forgetting about them altogether. Do you have anyone in your life like that? Anybody that has so violated your standards that they just don't own a piece of your heart anymore? They've just been set aside. And you've used new categories to think about them. I mean, I'm not going to disrespect them as a human being, of course, but we're not going to be, you know, sisters in the Lord anymore. We're not going to be friends at work. That's not going to work out. Jesus says that person is worthy of your prayers and your attention. When you have private time alone with the Lord, he wants that person to dominate your thoughts. That's love. And we've said, but in light of what they've done, I'm just not even going to think about them. That's hatred. Or Jesus said that you're to bless, or to use another word, to do good to them. That's what love would be. But because of how many hurtful things they've done to you, when you have scarce resources of time, when you have a little bit of extra money, you're not taking it to do good for them. You need to survive them. And so that money's probably for you. Or if nothing is, it's for the people in your life that are doing good to you, right? I mean, that's the way that the margin of your life ought to be spent. Remember, these are a lot less wealthy folks than we are. We've got examples of wealthy people in the New Testament. Those are not largely the people that are gathered around the mountain to hear Jesus speak. These are people whose income is exhausted at the end of the day. So if there's any margin left, Jesus said, that margin, guess what? I gave it to you. It's for your enemies. Your time, a little bit of extra money, that emotional bandwidth you've got to be able to face the day, I want you to bless that person who screwed up your life. That's love. Hatred is saying, yeah, forget it. See, if we define it in those terms, it's a lot easier, if we're being honest, to just say, Jesus says, love my enemies, don't hate them. And I'm like, well, I haven't killed them. Maybe we should go back a few sermons. Because if the standard of obedience to the law is making sure it didn't steal their spouse or didn't end their life, well, you're probably okay. It's just that's not the way Jesus is addressing these things. So we can't take love and hatred in those kind of big, easy, shallow categories. Jesus has been going deep week after week after week, and he's doing it again here. And the deepest part of this text is the target of your love. And you say, I don't know a single person who loves like that. And we look around the room. Are we good at it? I mean, I don't know. Maybe there's selected examples of times and of moments. I could tell you stories in this room of people who've taken jobs to bless and earn extra income so that they could do good to people that have not been doing good to them. In this room. I can tell you stories of times I've sat with folks and they have, through tears, recounted the way that other people have offended them and hurt them and given them night after night of sleeplessness and pain and anxiety. And at the end of those tears, they take a deep breath and they say, what can I do now in order to help them? That's in this room. So maybe we are capable of this. But you'd ask, why? Is it maybe it's the, you know, I don't know, whatever personality test you like. But maybe it's just those personalities of the people that are in here, right? If you're one of those DISC or if you're one of the Enneagram people or something along those lines. We have categories of people reserved for love of the enemy. That's probably one of the numbers out there, right? Or we'll just make a number 11. People good at loving their enemies. That's a number. It's just not my number. But just to be honest, that's not the association this text makes. It's who's your dad? That's where this one goes. Pray for those who persecute you so that you may be sons or daughters of your Father who is in heaven. That's the association. Parents, you ever have these kinds of thoughts for your kids? Kids, you ever heard these kinds of thoughts from your parents? That's just not the way we do stuff in our family. You ever said that or heard that? Or if it was never said, you ever done something that violated the family rule? And you got the raised eyebrow, like, in this home? You said that word in this kitchen? You want to tell us that story around this table? That's not what we do in this family. We don't spend money like that in this family. We don't take jobs like that in this kind of family. There's probably something a little twisted about how most of that goes down. But that is exactly the heartbeat that Jesus is appealing to out of this text. Because he doubles down and says this: here's what your dad is like. He makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good. He sends rain on the just and on the unjust. Now, we like half of that. We love half of that text, the kind of text that comes out of Deuteronomy 11. If you will obey my commandments that I command you today, to love the Lord your God and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul. These are the words of Moses to his people. Moses at the end of his days, giving a forecast of what life could look like. If you obey God, here's what he'll do. He'll give you the rain for your land in its season, the early rain and the later rain, that you may gather in your grain and your wine and your oil. We love that part of Jesus' promise here, don't we? He makes his sun rise on the good. He sends rain on the just. Deuteronomy 11, it's right there. If you obey God, that's what he's going to do. And that's true. But boy, how many heresies come from the fallacy that comes next. If Deuteronomy 11 says that if you obey God, he'll send rain, then in every single occasion, then we can say, if there's no rain, you haven't obeyed God. Or if you disobey God, you won't get the rain. And maybe that's true, except for Jesus says, it ain't. It's not true. He makes the sun rise on the evil. He sends rain on the unjust. That's the kind of God he is. Aren't you glad? Because how good and just are you? How much rain ought God have given you? How much sun do you think your life has earned? Aren't you grateful that this isn't the disposition of your Father toward you? I mean, yeah, but I'm his son. He's got to earn me something, right? All right, let's study God a little bit more. Job 37 says this: he loads thick clouds with moisture. The clouds scatter his lightning. They turn around by his guidance to accomplish all that he commands them on the face of the habitable world. Whether for correction, or for his land, or for love, he causes it to happen. Job is messing with our formula. God's in charge of the rain, no doubt about that. Why he does it? Who can tell? Maybe it's because he loves you. Maybe it's because he's correcting you. Maybe it's just because it's his land in the first place, and he thought he should put some water in it. Maybe that's all that's going on. What do you know? I don't know, Job. You're kind of messing with my world. All right, let's mess with it a little bit more. Remember that moment when Elijah is going up against Ahab and Jezebel? Ahab, Jezebel, the pinnacle of wickedness in Israel. Elijah, the pinnacle of godliness in Israel. Big old showdown, right? Well, how does that showdown between the 400 prophets of Baal, all on the team of Ahab and Jezebel, and Elijah, the only prophet of God, all on the team of Elijah, how did that happen? Well, here's how it happened. Chapter 17, verse 1 of 1 Kings, Elijah said to Ahab, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these years except by my word." Apparently, it was for correction. God just decided, no more. Elijah, go tell Ahab, he's not getting rain for a long time. And it was a long time. And at the end of that time, you know the story. Elijah comes again to Ahab and says, I'd like you to gather all your prophets together. Let them put on a display. See if they can get rain to come. See if they can get fire to come on this altar. Let's see what they can do to affect things. We'll have a big showdown. End of the story is, after all the wailing and all the cutting of themselves and all the pagan chants they've got, they get nothing. In a drought, Elijah decides to take extra buckets of water and pour it on a fire, and he gets fire from heaven that sets things ablaze. At the end of that showdown, Elijah says, why don't we kill all the prophets of Baal? That's exactly what happens. Where in that process does Ahab or Jezebel repent? Nowhere. Nowhere in the process do they repent. In fact, after all of it's done, Jezebel threatens Elijah's life. But you know what happens at the end of that moment? Chapter 18, verse 41. Elijah sends a message to Ahab, go up, eat, and drink, for there is the sound of the rushing of rain. And by the time these guys can get in their chariots and get home, the torrents of rain are coming behind them. I know of no better illustration from the Old Testament that God sends rain on the evil and on the unjust than that exact moment. I get the beginning of it. Nobody's as wicked as Ahab or Jezebel, and so God withholds rain. But then God just gives it again. He just is going to do good to the people that want to kill Elijah. Why? It's the way he is, guys. And that's Jesus' point. This is the way he is. So I say to you, Matthew 5:44, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you so that you can be part of the family. So that you may be sons of your Father who's in heaven. And Paul borrows on this language exactly. He says later on, do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may be blameless and innocent. He says it this way, children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you want to shine as lights in the world. In fact, in so many ways, that doesn't borrow just from Jesus here. That borrows from Jesus at the very beginning, doesn't it? He's saying, you're going to be a light in the world. Well, what's going to make that light shine even more so than darkness right around you? And what's going to look dark right around you any more than people mistreating you directly because of your faith or indirectly because of your faith? But in the moment that the darkness is all around you, what do you want to do? You want to fight fire with fire. And Jesus says, last week, no. And this week he says, but instead, love, pray, bless, do good. Because that's the way your dad is. Guys, that's the message. These are your choices. If you've been in a pattern of justifying what we're putting in a category of hatred, ignoring somebody else and treating them as though they're dead, what a counselor I heard one time say to the client who was right in front of him, who was me, it's as though the circumstances of your life have put this other person in the electric chair, and you didn't go over to them and hack them with a machete. You didn't go over and pour gasoline on them and set them on fire. You didn't actively murder them. All you had to do was from the sanitary room that you were in, you just had to stop and push the button, and you did. And I realized, guilty as charged. I shut them out. I wrote them off. And I said, after everything you did, you're dead to me. And if you've got some folks strapped into chairs this morning in your life, if your finger's been on the button, then hear this. There's still time. That relationship doesn't have to be dead. That moment of execution doesn't have to take place. The order could be belayed right here in this moment by the power of the Spirit of God in your life. If you've been ready to kill your spouse, if you've been ready to kill your friend, if you've just been ready to write them off because they are such an enemy. Jesus says, let's just pay attention to your dad for a minute one more time. Because the evil and the unjust got the sun and they got the rain. Can't you learn something from that? The one funding the prophets of Baal got torrents of rain for his land. Can't we learn something from that? So we have a choice before us. But let me give you more bad news. You don't get to write this off with what one of my sixth grade students back in the day called pagan love. And he got that because back in the day we used to memorize this and it was taken out of the NIV. The NIV reads a little bit different than what we read here. Let's read it in the ESV first. This choice comes down to Matthew chapter 5:46 and Matthew 5:47. If you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even tax collectors do the same? If you greet only your brothers, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles, that's the literal translation here, the Gentiles didn't seem to have the force to the NIV translators at the time. So they thought, well, what were the Gentiles in that day like? They were the pagans of the day. They were the polytheistic idol worshipers of the day. And so they were the pagans. And so it read, do not even the pagans do the same. That's what my sixth grader called pagan love. Most of our Christmas parties are pagan love. Not because of the Christmas tree or whatever you think about that stuff. But because this is pagan love. I'm going to give you a gift. It's roughly going to be $25 this year. Yeah, we're good with that. Okay, great. All right, and I'll get a $25 gift back from you. Oh, wonderful. You know, in the past, this hasn't gone so well because I haven't gotten what I've wanted. So I've created a website with all of my wants. You've created a website with all of your wants. And in the $25 category, I've got this and you've got that. Pagan love. I said hi to you and you said hi to me. Pagan love. I invited you over to my place. I spent a little more than I would have on a meal, but you're going to do the same thing for me. One hand washing the other, pagan love. That doesn't count, Jesus said. That's not life in the kingdom. That's just life in the world, everybody. This is how business works. I pay for something and I get the value of what I spent. I mean, if we did a good job. But that's just transactions. That's the way the economy of the world works. This is the economy of the kingdom. Pay for something of no value to you. Go to the store and pay for something that you're not going to get to take home with you. That's not pagan love. That might be kingdom love. Don't find someone cute in your life who's just a little unfortunate. Find someone who's actually opposed you, hurt you, maligned you, and then find a way to bless them and promote them and get them going on in this world. That's the kind of love Jesus is saying that the Father of Heaven puts forward. And these are our choices. Now, in a little teaser for what's going to come up in a couple weeks when we get into Matthew chapter 6, Jesus uses a word here. If you love those who love you, he uses this in 46, what reward do you have? cool language. And if it gets you thinking a little bit, that's good. Because this is a really popular biblical word. We read it all the way back when God is meeting Abraham in Genesis chapter 15. He says, After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Fear not, Abram, I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great. Now, the dilemma of Abram's life, meeting this great God with unlimited resources and unlimited power, who can only do good for him, and he can't really do much good for him. The reward is going to be the question here for a while. Because Abram's next question is, but I don't have a kid, so how can you reward me? The other way of translating this is, fear not, Abram, I am your shield, your very great reward. And if we pick up on the nuance of that, not only are we going to get this passage, we're going to set ourselves up for the ones to come. Because so much of our life is lived thinking the way that my dog used to think. We had a hard time teaching our dog to be able to roll over. Dawson was not the smartest of beasts. He could sort of spin around. He could sort of bark. He could sort of do a thing with a paw. But the rolling over was comical. He could not figure out the axis he was supposed to turn on. And so he'd contort himself around and then look at us and go, do I get the peanut butter? And we were like, that wasn't it, man. Try it again. Roll over. And he'd be like, oh, I'm flopping. I'm flailing. Do I get the peanut butter? And we would say, sure, there you go, buddy. It was pitiful. Trying to just watch him to do a few things. All of a sudden, Zach and Leila have a dog. That little puppy comes in. It's performing calculus over in the corner, you know. And Dawson's like, I don't know what's going on. We're still giving him peanut butter. That's kind of the way this is, if we're just honest. We have the Lord of Rewards watching us. And we're flailing around trying, was that it? Was that love, God? And he's like, not really, but okay. You tried. I get it. You were going for it, you know? Let me show you my true son for a second. Let's watch him suffer with his enemies. Let's watch him be beaten. Let's watch him proclaim this new kingdom to those who would be the abusers in the kingdom and of the kingdom. And then let's watch him lay down his life in front of them as well. This it? Did I do it? Did I imitate him? Sort of. Most of us are there. If we're honest, it's about as good as we can get. But not only do we have a God who sends sun and rain on the evil and the unjust, we also have a God who rewards the pitiful. And aren't we grateful for that? Because somehow in the process, we just start to get it. Somehow in the process of him bringing us along and showing us a little bit more, we start to become little bit by little bit more like Jesus. The standard we're going to read next week is we're called to be perfect as our Heavenly Father is perfect. I just thought we needed a full week on that one. So we're going to end here, but we're going to end with three questions. Not so much questions, but statements that ask a question. The question is, are you okay with that? Here's the first statement. As I read these, let me invite the worship team to come back. They, together with these, are going to prepare us for communion together. So first statement is this. We are called to love all within our family and all who harm them. You okay with that? I'm okay with half of that. I'm okay with being called to love and to sacrifice and to serve my family. But you mess with them? Oh. And Jesus says, yeah, go do the same for those too. I'm okay to love all within my church family. But you want to start messing with Trinity Church? You're going down until my Father in heaven says, actually, I shone sun on them and I sent rain on them. And I watered their crops too. So just go love them, okay? Pray for them, bless them, do good to them. That's what we're called to. Another choice. We are called to love all who support our cause, and we're called to love all those who tear it down. And I'm sure that's exactly the way you are whenever you make your way onto Facebook or any other political forum online, right? That's what we celebrate, is those who support our causes, we love them. But what about those who would tear down our cause? What about those who would, we're going to take Tuesday night, we're going to be praying for Cornerstone Pregnancy at their two facilities in Elyria and at Cam's Corner. And we're going to take time Tuesday night to pray for all those who would oppose the pro-life cause in the greater Cleveland area. And that is hard to do. It is hard to do. But that's a broad cause. What about all the other personal causes close to you? We're called to love those in support and those who are our enemies. Lastly, we are called to love all who model justice and all who profit from sin. Both political parties. Every bit of economic energy that makes its way across our economy and across the world coming out from the United States. We're called to love all who model justice and all who profit from sin. What we're never called to do is pretend they're not our enemies. So what I don't want you to hear me saying in any of this is that the category of enemy doesn't exist. That's what the world would have us believe. That there really are no enemies, that because the call to love is there, everybody just gets to be a friend. We all just have to agree. Everybody's all in the same. That's not the category that's there. Jesus is saying there are clear enemies. But if you want to be on my side, if you want to reflect my Father, here's the way to act toward them. Love them and bless them and pray for them while they oppose you, while they seek to harm you, while they seek to tear down what you're building up. Bless them anyway, because that's what we do in this family. And aren't we grateful that that's what God did? Paul said, while we were enemies, we were reconciled by the death of his son. We're going to take communion in a minute or two. So I invite you to stand. We're going to sing a song that'll prep us for this. And if what you've been thinking this whole time is, Darren, I hear the call, I see the text, but that would kill me. That would just literally kill me. Then maybe we're actually getting close to understanding the love of God in the first place. Let's sing together.